We have Elliot Grossman on the line here from California. Mr. Grossman is one of the lawyers for Mumia Abu-Jamal, a black political prisoner who has been imprisoned in the United States for the last 20 years after being wrongly convicted of killing police officer Daniel Faulkner. Mr. Grossman, thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
First of all, what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask you a couple of questions about the evidence from the original trial and some of the problems with that evidence. Then we're going to move on and maybe talk about some of the new evidence that's come out recently, some of the new developments.
All right, that's fine.
At the original trial, as I understand it, there were really three key planks to the prosecution's case. Firstly, eyewitness testimony. Secondly, a bogus confession that they claimed Mumia made. And finally, the ballistics evidence. Maybe you could describe what's wrong with that evidence, why it's really not credible, why people shouldn't believe it. So firstly, with the eyewitness testimony.
With regard to the eyewitness testimony, there were only two alleged eyewitnesses who claimed to have seen Mumia shoot Officer Faulkner. Cynthia White, who is a prostitute with numerous arrests and several open cases, who was obviously, just because of that, highly vulnerable to police manipulation, and a white cab driver named Robert Schobert. Now, what has happened since we came into the case as Mumia's attorneys in May of 2001 is that we found a witness, Yvette Williams, who was actually in jail with Cynthia White right after the incident occurred when Faulkner was shot, who gave us a statement under penalty of perjury, which we filed in court, in which she says that Cynthia White told her that actually she had not even seen the shooting, although she was in the area, that police picked her up as she was trying to leave the area after the shooting stopped, showed her a picture of Mumia, took her down to the police station, and told her that she had to identify him as the shooter. Otherwise, they were going to consolidate all her cases together and send her off to state prison for a long period of time. Yvette Williams also says that Cynthia White was very frightened when she was in prison. She was afraid that the police were going to kill her if she didn't go along with them, and she was also afraid that if she stayed in custody, by the time she got out, her pimp was going to kill her or beat her up very severely because he was going to be angry at all the money he was losing while she was locked up. The other thing that Yvette Williams says is that when the police would take Cynthia White out of her cell to talk to her, she would come back with a lot of contraband items that the rest of the inmates weren't allowed to have, sandwiches and soft drinks and drugs, white powder and syringes. So there's really very little reason to believe Cynthia White's testimony. In addition to the fact that every time the police interviewed Cynthia White, according to her written witness statements, her testimony changed so that it was, you know, worse for Mumia's side of the case every time they talked to her, you know, which indicates that the police were continuously pressuring her to keep changing her testimony until they got exactly what they wanted. And there's one last additional complication with Cynthia White, which is that at the trial of Mumia's brother, who was also present at the scene and who was tried separately from him about a month earlier on misdemeanor charges of interfering with an officer, Cynthia White testified that, you know, well, the incident basically started when a police officer stopped a car being driven by Mumia's brother, Billy Cook. And Cynthia White testified that there was a passenger in the car with Billy Cook and that the passenger got out of the car when the officer stopped the car. That was her testimony in Billy Cook's trial. But in Mumia's trial, she never mentioned the passenger. And when she was specifically asked if anyone else was present at the scene of the incident by the prosecutor, she said no. Now, this is very important because the prosecutor argued to the jury his basic theory of the case that there were only three people present at the scene of the crime: Officer Faulkner, Mumia Abu-Jamal, and his brother Billy Cook, and that since Billy Cook didn't do it, according to the prosecutor, and Officer Faulkner got shot, the only person who could have done it, supposedly, according to the prosecutor, was Mumia. But the fact that there was someone else present at the crime scene, the passenger, completely destroys that theory by the prosecution. And the fact that Cynthia White, their key witness, had revealed the presence of the passenger at Billy Cook's trial, but lied about it at Mumia's trial, would have been extremely significant at the original trial if that had been brought up, particularly because the same prosecutor who prosecuted Mumia was the prosecutor who prosecuted Billy Cook. So he had to have known when Cynthia White was testifying against Mamiya that she was lying in concealing the existence of the passenger. And not only did he have to know it, it had to have been the prosecutor who told Cynthia White to lie and leave the passenger out of it, because she would have had no particular reason of her own to have done that. So that basically wipes out Cynthia White's testimony. Now, the other alleged eyewitness they had is this guy, Robert Schobert, who was a white cab driver who claimed that he was parked behind the police car when the incident occurred, saw the whole thing, and supposedly saw Mamiya shoot the police officer. Now, we discovered when we took over the case from the previous attorneys that an investigator named Mike Newman had actually gone out and interviewed Robert Schobert back in 1995 at the time of the post-conviction hearings in front of Judge Sabol. And Robert Schobert had admitted to the investigator that actually he didn't see the shooting either. He wasn't even parked behind the police car. He was parked on the side street, which means that what would have happened behind him and off to his right. And he was sitting in his cab. He heard shots. He got out. He looked up. And down the street a ways, he saw a black man standing up next to a police car, suddenly slumped down. He walked over to see what was happening, and he saw a police officer sprawled out on his back, and a black man sitting down on in the same general area. But when Schobert testified at the trial, he had a totally different story. He claimed that he actually saw Mamiya shoot the police officer, which was an absolute lie. Now, Mike Newman says that he gave all of this information to Mamiya's previous attorney, Leonard Weinglass. And Leonard Weinglass put this witness, Robert Schobert, on the witness stand during the post-conviction hearings in 1995, but never asked him about the fact that he had actually told the investigator that he didn't see the shooting at all and retracted all of his trial testimony. Mike Newman was in the courthouse at the time available to testify about what Schobert had told him. But after Schobert was off the witness stand, Leonard Weinglass went up to Mike Newman and told him that he could leave. It was unnecessary for him to testify because supposedly he'd gotten everything he needed out of Schobert. And Mike Newman didn't know that, in fact, this was not true until we took over the case and contacted him, and all this information came out. There's also problems in the case related to the fact that the original trial attorney at the time of Mamiya's trial did not try to win the case. The appeals attorney who handled Mamiya's original appeal never raised numerous issues of error in the trial in terms of violations of Mamiya's constitutional rights, including the absolutely deplorable performance by his trial attorney. And then Leonard Weinglass and Daniel Williams, the attorneys who previously represented Mamiya in post-conviction, did not raise a number of key issues as well as evidence, including the fact that Robert Schobert took back his trial testimony, and most importantly, they refused to go forward with and buried the confession of the man who actually did kill Daniel Faulkner, a man named Arnold Beverly, whose confession we filed in court as soon as we came into the case. But that takes care of the eyewitnesses. Now, he had also mentioned that there was evidence of a phony confession by Mamiya. 2 months after the incident occurred, all of a sudden the police came forward and claimed that while Mamiya was lying seriously wounded, because he himself had been shot in the incident, while he was in the hospital with a bullet lodged at the base of his spine, with massive hemorrhaging going on inside his body, being, worked on by the doctors trying to save his life, supposedly, according to the prosecution, Mamiya had blurted out this vulgar statement, "I shot the motherfucker, and I hope he dies." This was completely lacking in any credibility whatsoever right from the get-go, because there were a whole bunch of police officers standing around Mamiya when he was in the emergency room. None of them ever reported this statement being made until 2 months later, all of a sudden, they come up with this thing. So that's the first element of unbelievability about this phony story. The second element is that the two officers who were actually with Mamiya the entire time he was there, Officer Waxhill and Officer Trombetta, both reported in written reports that Mumia had made no statements at all during the time that they were responsible for him, which is the time that this statement was allegedly made. And the last thing, which defies any belief, is that under the circumstances, you know, police officer's been killed, fellow police officers are there at the hospital standing around the guy who's the suspect of having done that. You know, and you've got a black suspect and you've got white police officers. If the person had actually made a statement like that, the police officers would have probably beaten them to death right there in the hospital. As it was when Mumia was arrested at the scene of the incident, the police officers kicked him and punched him and beat him up rather badly and jammed his head into a utility pole several times. So the entire story just has no shred of credibility whatsoever, but it's extremely inflammatory. And in the context of the original trial and the racial polarization in Philadelphia, it was certainly a factor in inflaming the jury against Mumia and getting the conviction. Now, the last element you want me to talk about was ballistics. Basically, there is no real ballistics evidence to prove anything. The bullet that was removed from Officer Faulkner, according to the police ballistics report, cannot be matched to Mumia's gun or any gun because the bullet is supposedly so deformed you cannot carry out the necessary testing on it to determine if it came from a particular gun. Now, there's an ambiguity there because we've seen photographs of the bullet, and the photographs of the bullet do not show a bullet that's so deformed it could not be tested. Plus, when the bullet was placed into an evidence envelope after the autopsy and sent to the police ballistics lab, there was placed into the envelope two items, a bullet and what was described as a bullet fragment. When that envelope arrived at the police ballistics lab, the alleged bullet fragment was mysteriously missing. So someone has obviously tampered with the evidence at the very inception of the investigation. Now, they also claim that the bullet in Mumia came from Officer Faulkner's gun. Now, we have very serious questions as to whether that's the case at all, because the gun that they present as allegedly being Officer Faulkner's gun doesn't appear to be Officer Faulkner's gun, based upon what we know about Officer Faulkner, because the gun is dirty. It wasn't properly cleaned. The hammer on the gun was bent, and it had oversized grips on it so that you couldn't actually cock the gun back in order to shoot it single action, as well as being able to shoot it double action by just pulling the trigger. We know that Officer Faulkner was working alone that night, supposedly, according to the police reports. It was never explained why his partner wasn't with him. He was working in a dangerous part of the city on, you know, the late night shift, and he was an experienced police officer, a veteran officer who had graduated in the top of his class from the police academy, had a number of decorations, was a combat veteran from Vietnam. It doesn't make sense. And he was an avid hunter, so he obviously knew about guns. It doesn't make sense he'd be carrying a dirty gun that was broken, basically, and had the wrong size grips on it so that you couldn't utilize it, you know, within the full range of, you know, possible use of the gun. It doesn't make sense that that would be his gun. So the ballistics evidence basically needs to be thoroughly reexamined, and we've requested that, but we haven't been given that opportunity by the courts as of now. So that basically kind of gives you the general scenario with regard to those particular items.
Obviously, there's been a lot of new evidence that's come up, as well as evidence which we're hearing for the first time, I suppose, because of a decision by the legal team. I mean, you guys have come in place. You've got a different strategy maybe than the previous legal teams. So, for example, we're hearing about the Beverly confession. I was wondering if you could let me know, in terms of your strategy around the Beverly confession, what do you think it means, and what's your strategy to bring it before the courts?
Okay, well, first of all, we need to clarify, this isn't really properly described as a new or a different strategy, because no attorney who wanted to properly represent their client would ever, under any circumstances, fail to go forward with a confession from the person who really did commit the crime, which exonerates their client, which is corroborated by a lie detector test showing the person is telling the truth, fits the prosecution's evidence from the original trial better than the prosecution's theory, and it's corroborated by a mountain of additional independent evidence. So this isn't a case where, you know, reasonable lawyers could disagree about the proper way to represent a client. This is a case where the previous attorneys betrayed Mumia Abu-Shamal and betrayed their own professional responsibility by burying evidence that proves that he's innocent, and thereby creating for us a tremendous procedural problem in terms of getting the courts in the United States, which are, you know, operating under the AEDPA, the effective death penalty and anti-terrorist laws, you know, creates tremendous procedural problems for us in getting the courts to actually look at the evidence itself that proves Mumia is innocent. And if the evidence had been presented when it was originally in the hands of the prior attorneys back in 1999, none of these procedural problems would exist. The only issue would be, is this evidence credible or not? And we would have had, there would have been no problem in directly dealing with the evidence. But we now have this whole additional problem, which also gives the prosecution, you know, the excuse to keep the real story out of court and, for their own particular reasons, you know, continue with the frame-up of Mumia that, you know, they've been running for the last 20 years. The evidence that we're talking about is, first and foremost, the confession of the man who killed police officer Faulkner, a man named Arnold Beverly, who's a professional killer, who was hired by the mafia and by corrupt police officers in the Philadelphia Police Department, with an accomplice to carry out the killing of Officer Faulkner, because Faulkner was a problem for the payoff racket that the police were running in downtown Philadelphia in the 1980s, a racket that was the subject of three independent FBI investigations, which resulted in federal prosecution of police officers, and as a result, 30 police officers were convicted and sent to jail, including the assistant chief of police in Philadelphia. The head of homicide was an unindicted co-conspirator in the federal investigations. The police captain, who was in charge of the entire downtown area where the incident occurred, where Faulkner was killed and Mumia was shot, and who supervised the downtown area and the precinct that Officer Faulkner worked out of, that particular police captain was convicted of corruption. The ranking police officer at the crime scene investigation resigned from the police force the day after Mumia's trial was over and pled no contest to charges of taking large amounts of money as bribes as part of the payoff racket. And basically what the police were doing is that they were going to the after-hour clubs and to the gay bars and to the prostitutes and pimps and drug dealers and number runners and saying that they had to pay them a percentage of their illegal earnings, or they were going to be arrested and harassed and driven out of business. So what Arnold Beverly says is Faulkner was a problem. It's possible that Faulkner was suspected of being an FBI informer because the word was out on the street that the FBI was investigating the police and that there were certain police officers who were acting as FBI informers. Beverly was hired, shown a photograph of Faulkner, told to go to the corner 13th and Locust and wait for him with the accomplice, that he was expected to be there to check something at a bar. Faulkner shows up, and they carry out the shooting. And one thing that's very interesting about Beverly's confession is that he reports that the accomplice shot Faulkner first, and Faulkner went down on one knee and then fell over, and then Beverly went up and stood over him and finished him off with a shot between the eyes at close range. Now, the autopsy report shows that Faulkner had a skin denudation on that knee. In other words, a little piece of skin gouged out of his knee. And photographs of his uniform trousers show that that knee on his trousers was ripped. So that's consistent with Beverly's story, and there's no way that Beverly would have had that information or known that if he hadn't actually been there. The other thing that Beverly says is that Mumia didn't come on the scene until after the shooting took place, and that Mumia was shot by another police officer arriving on the scene. He was not shot by Faulkner. And this is also very interesting because one of the first reports from the police at the scene was, in fact, the same thing, that Mumia had been shot by arriving police reinforcements. Now, at the original trial, when they tried to present that evidence from those police officers, Judge Szabo refused to let that evidence go in front of the jury. Instead, he held a hearing in his chambers, which is like his office, where the officers testified, and then he refused to let them testify in the actual courtroom in front of the jury. So that evidence was never made public. And there's no way that Arnold Beverly could have known about that either, unless he was there.
Okay, we're speaking with Elliot Grossman, one of the lawyers for Mumia Abu-Jamal, a political prisoner in the United States. Mr. Grossman, Mumia and his brother have both made statements now about what happened that night. Could you tell us what you think the significance of those statements are? Are they consistent with the Beverly confession? And what's your strategy in regards to those statements?
Well, the statements are highly significant for a number of reasons. One is that the story that had been told in 1995 at the post-conviction hearing by the previous attorney for Mumia, Leonard Weinglass, was that Mumia's brother basically had disappeared and refused to testify and wasn't available to testify. But what Mumia's brother says in his statement, which we obtained from him, which we filed in court, was that he was expecting to testify at the hearing, but he was getting cross signals from Leonard Weinglass because one of the other attorneys in the case, Rachel Wolkenstein, wanted him to testify, but the message he was getting from Leonard Weinglass was not to testify, but that he was willing and able and available to testify. And also, when we took over the case from the prior attorneys, not only did we find the confession from Arnold Beverly, which had never been presented before, dating back to June of 1999, we also found a written statement under penalty of perjury by Mumia's brother, Billy Cook, dating from the same period, approximately May of 1999, in which he told the story of what had happened. And what he says in that declaration, and then he expanded upon in terms of giving more details in the declaration that we got from him, was that he was driving his Volkswagen around the area of 13th and Locust with his business partner and friend, Kenneth Freeman, when they were stopped by police officer Faulkner. As Billy Cook was looking around to try to find his registration and his driver's license, all of a sudden, shots rang out. He looked up, and Kenneth Freeman had disappeared. He sees Mumia coming toward the scene, and all of a sudden, Mumia is shot and goes down. And eventually, you know, the police come and grab Billy Cook and take him away and, you know, tell him that they're going to kill him and throw him in the river, etc. And the most significant thing, sometime afterward, Kenneth Freeman told him that he, Kenneth Freeman, had been armed that night, that there was a plot to kill police officer Faulkner, and that Kenneth Freeman was part of the plot. Kenneth Freeman, then, is the passenger who was in Billy Cook's car at the time the incident took place. The passenger who Cynthia White identified, but in Billy Cook's trial, but denied the existence of in Mumia's trial. We also found a witness, Arnold Howard, who was taken into custody along with Kenneth Freeman the same day that the incident occurred, but it happened about 4 in the morning. And then later that day, the police found a temporary driver's license at the scene belonging to Arnold Howard, and they went out and they arrested him. And Arnold Howard told them that he had loaned that temporary driver's license to Kenneth Freeman, so they went out and got Kenneth Freeman. According to Arnold Howard's declaration that we filed in court, Kenneth Freeman was in a lineup that day, and Cynthia White pulled him out of the lineup twice and identified him. But that evidence was never turned over to the defense. And interestingly enough, Arnold Howard says he told this to Leonard Weinglass. But in the 1995 post-conviction hearings, when Weinglass had Arnold Howard on the witness stand, he asked him about the fact that a black woman identified Kenneth Freeman out of the lineup, but never asked him who the black woman was, although he knew, according to Arnold Howard, that it was Cynthia White, the prosecution's star witness. Now, the only other element here in this whole complicated situation is that we also have declarations from Rachel Wolkenstein, a former attorney on the case, and Mike Newman, the investigator, saying that Leonard Weinglass had told them that he had received a death threat from Kenneth Freeman's brother at the time of the post-conviction hearings, telling him specifically that if he presented any evidence that would point toward Kenneth Freeman's involvement in the crime, that he would be dead meat. So that's Billy Cook's statement. Now, Mumia's statement, you know, one of the things that's been used against Mumia's political defense campaign for years is the fact that his brother had never come forward and testified, and, you know, now we've explained what his brother's testimony was and the fact that he had come forward, but the lawyers would not present his testimony, and also the fact that Mumia had never come forward and testified, although Mumia did insist at the time of his original trial, when he did make a statement to the jury at the end of the trial, that he was innocent. What Mumia says in his declaration, which we, when we took over the case, we met with Mumia and advised him that he should give a statement as to what happened, and he agreed to do that, and he gave us a statement as to what had happened. And what Mumia says is that the reason he didn't testify at the original trial was because the trial was such a farce, basically. All of his constitutional rights were violated in the trial. They didn't allow him to defend himself. They forced this incompetent lawyer on him who didn't really seem to want to win the case and wouldn't let Mumia represent himself. Mumia felt that he wasn't going to make it look like he was, you know, he was going to legitimize that unfair trial by then taking the stand when they wouldn't let him actually present his defense anyway. But in 1995, at the time of the post-conviction hearings in front of Judge Szabo, his attorney, Leonard Weinglass, advised him not to testify. And the only reason he didn't testify at that time was because his lawyer told him not to testify, and he followed his lawyer's advice. And what Mumia says in his statement is that basically he was driving a taxi cab that night, which was something that he did, you know, to augment his income. He's like moonlighting as a taxi driver. And at 13th and Locust, there are a bunch of after-hour clubs where at 4 o'clock in the morning, a lot of customers come out when the clubs close. So he was waiting at the intersection of 13th and Locust in his cab in front of one of these clubs to find a customer to pick up. All of a sudden, he heard gunshot. He got out of his cab, and he saw his brother standing in the area of where, you know, the shooting was going on, looking dazed, and he ran toward his brother. And when he got close to his brother, the next thing he knew, there was a police officer standing, a uniformed police officer with his back to him, who turned around, and a gun went off, and Mumia was shot, and Mumia went down. And the next thing he knew, he woke up, and there were a bunch of policemen around him, kicking him and pummeling him. And they threw him into a paddy wagon and were taking him, apparently, off to the city jail. And given the condition he was in terms of being wounded, if they had actually carried through with that, he undoubtedly would have died by the time he'd gotten to city jail, in a similar fashion to the death of Stephen Biko in South Africa. And then a call came through on the radio, the police radio, directing them to take him to the hospital instead. And Mumia specifically says in his declaration he did not shoot Faulkner, and that the statement that they claim he made in the hospital, the alleged confession, he never made that statement, and that's basically what Mumia says in his declaration. And this is completely consistent with the other evidence we have from Arnold Beverly and other witnesses with regard to what really did happen that night.
In December, a higher court decided that Mumia isn't going to be getting the death penalty, that that's going to be basically a life imprisonment sentence instead. A lot of people are using this as an excuse to say, you know what, I really don't want to spend the energy or the time working around this case. How would you respond to people who say that?
Well, first of all, that's not entirely accurate. What happened was that the federal court, the district court, temporarily threw out the death penalty on the basis of a bad jury instruction in the penalty phase of the trial. But that particular issue is on appeal. The prosecution is trying to overthrow that decision. And if the prosecution is successful, then the death penalty would be reinstated. At the same time, we're appealing to throw out Mumia's conviction because there's numerous reasons why it should be thrown out, given that he did not have a fair trial, and also the evidence we have now, which proves that, in fact, he's innocent and he didn't do it. But if we should lose our side of the appeal, and if the prosecution should lose their side of the appeal, then there would be a new hearing, a new sentencing hearing, and they could try to give him the death penalty again. So Mumia's life still hangs in the balance, number one. By no means is the death penalty out of this case, although we have won a tremendously important battle in the overall fight to free Mumia. At the same time, Mumia is innocent. He did not kill the police officer. He is the victim of not only a frame-up, but a cover-up designed to protect the people who actually are responsible for the death of Officer Faulkner, and I mean the people who hired Arnold Beverly and planned and organized the murder of Officer Faulkner. And it's just as much of an injustice for Mumia to spend the rest of his life in prison when he's innocent. So the fight to free Mumia is still very much on the agenda of the movement for progressive social change in the United States and Canada and around the world, because Mumia's case is a microcosm of everything which is wrong with the criminal justice system in the United States and in other so-called democracies, not only with the death penalty, and certainly with the death penalty, but with the entire so-called criminal justice system. And also, there's an important political element to Mumia's case as well, which is Mumia's role as the voice of the voiceless. Mumia is one of the most articulate and consistent spokespeople for the movement for progressive social change around the world. He, locked up on death row, continues to write and to send out his columns on the burning issues of the day, particularly now the so-called war against terrorism, exposing the reality of what's actually going on behind Bush's campaign to further consolidate the role of the United States as the international policeman on behalf of the international economic ruling elite. And there are many political forces who want to silence Mumia because of that. They want to discredit him with this label of cop killer. And, you know, there's disagreements in the ruling elite as to whether they want him dead or alive in prison for the rest of his life. But that's clearly part of what's going on here. So it's important to continue the struggle to free Mumia because it's emblematic of the struggles of all unjustly convicted persons, and it's also part of the overall struggle for social and political and economic transformation throughout the world.
Mr. Grossman, I think that's a really, really strong point to end on. So with that, I just want to thank you very much for your time. Thank you for speaking to us today.
Thank you. Goodbye.